This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
My name was spelled in baseball cards where the hors d'oeuvres were. It said Darren's Dugout. I can close my eyes and tell you exactly how it looked.
Darren Revelle, a sports business reporter at ESPN, remembers a lot of things about his bar mitzvah in 1991.
There was like a barbershop quartet singing baseball songs when you entered. It was pretty over the top.
Really?
But yeah, it was pretty, yeah, it was, believe it or not. A Long Island bar mitzvah, it's like people are competing.
Sometimes the competition was fierce. Mickey Mantle was the celebrity guest at the bar mitzvah of one of Revelle's friends. Like that friend, young Revelle was a baseball fan, but he figured correctly that Mantle would have blown the top off the Revelle family bar mitzvah budget. Beyond that, Revelle felt that if he hosted a baseball legend, he'd be pretending to be somebody he wasn't.
I had followed minor league players. I had followed scouting reports and, you know, player development departments. And I mean, that was like a geeky thing that I did. So if I brought a player who was already great to my bar mitzvah, well, that wasn't fun.
Accordingly, young Darren suggested two minor league prospects, both of them in the Mets organization, and two young major leaguers, each of whom might need the extra few $100 he could earn by schlepping out to a bar mitzvah in Long Island. Now, it wasn't as if failure on Mr. Revelle's part would mean Darren's bar mitzvah would be utterly lacking in baseball celebrity. A neighbor knew Bud Harrelson, who'd played for the Mets, Phillies, and Rangers and was managing the Mets in 91. Harrelson had agreed to show up. Still, the player is the thing, so Darren Revelle's dad went to work on that list.
And when you go back in 1990, 1991, we didn't have Google to easily find things. And so he, I know, looked at this as a challenge that, one, he wanted to pull it off. Two, he thought he could pull it off. And then he began the process. The Astros were playing the Mets on the night of my bar mitzvah. Craig Biggio was one of the guys on my list. He was playing for the Astros. And the venue was 13 miles from Shea Stadium. So this was technically doable to get one of the players on my list. He called the Astros, and they said probably not something that Craig Biggio would do, but we have a young player who we think might be game to do this. Not that he's done so many things, but that he's a prospect, he's doing really well, you might want him.
Caminiti was going, it's skied to left, Deion Sanders at the wall, and Bagwell has his first Major League home run. Jeff Bagwell has delivered.
And they mentioned the name Jeff Bagwell.
At this point, Darren's dad went above and beyond. He not only got in touch with Astros rookie Jeff Bagwell, he arranged to meet Bagwell at a hotel in New York so he could pay Bagwell's $500 fee. Bagwell even agreed to buy a sport coat for the celebration. He hadn't brought one on the road trip. You know, I've done my homework on this, and I've looked at some of the photographs of the occasion, and Jeff Bagwell doesn't look a whole lot older than you do. Did anybody mistake him for just another guest?
I'm sure. He also doesn't look much like, no offense to Jeff, and I don't think he cares right now, but it's not like he was some guy who looked like an athlete, and I'm sure he walked around, and I'm sure he had his mini hot dog and his Coke, and no one looked twice until he was sitting in the corner with a Sharpie.
And so Darren's guests lined up for signatures.
The kids were a little bit confused as to why the manager was there, but I didn't get a star like Dwight Gooden or Darryl Strawberry or Gary Carter or like any random Met. Why did I have an Astros player? So although he was signing autographs, and although I was enthralled and starstruck, I think the kids who were at the party were less than thrilled that this is who was signing an autograph. And I don't have any faith that any of those kids kept that beyond the week or two.
And as a rookie, Jeff Bagwell might have kind of wondered why anybody outside of Houston would hold on to his autographed card. Happily, Bud Harrelson was there to provide references.
He got up there and he said, "Hey, you know, I just want to let you guys know we're playing the Astros, and the young man sitting in the corner over there is a great young player, and he just hit the longest home run in Three Rivers Stadium history."
For protection, here's a high towering drive to deep left field, and this one is gone. Look at this upper deck, well into the upper deck.
What a shot by Bagwell.
That home run was no fluke. Bagwell hit 14 more of them during his first season and was named the National League's Rookie of the Year. Over the next 14 years, he hit another 435 home runs and was once named the league's MVP. Last week, it was announced that Bagwell will be inducted into the Hall of Fame in July, which is reason number one why those kids at Darren Revelle's bar mitzvah should have held on to those autographed cards. Needless to say, Darren Revelle enjoyed each of the achievements that led eventually to Jeff Bagwell's election to the Hall.
It definitely did become fun, and I would say over the years there were 50 calls between me and my dad and my brother and my mom. Can you believe we had them? And there was always a call when something crazy happened, you know, for something as little as he had four RBIs in a night. So there was some sort of connection that we felt to him.
So whereas lots of kids can say they've met a major leaguer, Darren Revelle can say he hosted a future Hall of Famer at his bar mitzvah. His only regret is that as a kid, he never followed up on the connection that bar mitzvah visit might have begun. As that anonymous young man with a mini hot dog in one hand and a Coke in the other metamorphosed into a major league star, Revelle never looked for Bagwell outside the player's gate at Shea Stadium to remind him of that great afternoon they'd had together. About a decade ago, at least 15 years after that big day on Long Island, Revelle did run into Jeff Bagwell in the Astros locker room shortly before a game. He asked if Bagwell remembered Revelle as the kid whose bar mitzvah he'd attended. Bagwell said he sort of recalled going to one. It wasn't exactly a great reunion, but it's never too late, right?
I intend to go to Cooperstown and go to the induction and maybe get an autographed ball that says, "From your bar mitzvah to Cooperstown, Jeff Bagwell."
And you've got to be rooting for it to happen, or at least I do. It's going to be a big day in Jeff Bagwell's life, sure, but wouldn't it be kind of a bigger day if he at least pretended that, "Oh yeah, I do remember that bar mitzvah, and it was a great day, kid. And here we both are today, successful beyond our wildest dreams, having made careers doing just what we'd wanted to do," or something like that. And then he'd sign Darren Revelle's baseball and hand it back to him with a big Hall of Famer smile. All this talk of the Baseball Hall of Fame has led me to think about the conversations that inevitably arise about who should have gotten into the shrine and when and why. Here's how I imagine one of those conversations might go. The coffee, when the waitress in the red apron set it down in front of him, was much too hot to drink.
"Good,"
Adam thought.
"More time for talk."
Then he said,
"Walter Johnson."
He didn't think he'd have to defend his choice of a pitcher from a century or so ago who'd gone about winning over 400 games for the Washington Senators, almost always a bad team.
"Long time before he ever won a World Series game,"
said Robbie.
"Long time before he ever had a chance to do it."
"Still."
"Okay, Ty Cobb."
"Character clause. Bragged that he killed a guy, whether he did it or not. Plus, he beat up a fan for heckling him. Guy didn't even have all his fingers."
"Made Cobb more famous."
"Made him suspended."
"Lots of guys got suspended. Got into the Hall of Fame anyway."
"Right, but off the point. Points who should have gotten in on a unanimous vote first time he was eligible. That's what we're talking about."
"Babe Ruth."
"Character clause."
"That's just stupid. Nobody wrote about character when Ruth was playing. Otherwise, fans would have known his bellyache wasn't a bellyache."
"What was it?"
"The clap, I heard."
"Something else that probably hasn't kept anybody out of the Hall of Fame. Anyway, you're right. The vote on Ruth should have been unanimous."
"What about Willie Mays?"
In a house in San Francisco, Willie Mays, 85, stirred in his sleep and smiled.
"Right,"
said Mickey Mantle, who was dead. In New York in the 50s and 60s, people used to argue about who was better, Mays or Mantle. In the afterworld, nobody argued about who'd been the best center fielder. Nobody argued about anything. In the afterworld, Mickey Mantle had learned to be gracious.
"Right, what?"
said Walter Johnson, who'd been dead even longer than Mickey Mantle had.
"Willie Mays should have been a unanimous pick for the Hall of Fame the first year he was eligible,"
said Mantle.
"He could hit as well as anybody who ever played the game, and he was a better fielder than I was. Much better."
"Who gives a damn?"
said Ty Cobb, also dead.
"You should, Tyrus.
Why?
Because as long as they argue about this stuff, you'll be remembered. Me too. Also, Mr. Mantle here, though there's plenty of people still alive who saw him play, which is not the case for you so much.
Who gives a damn?
Said Ty Cobb, who had not learned anything much in the afterworld. Adam took a small sip of his coffee and found it had cooled off some. He took a larger sip and said,
Pete Rose.
Right,
said Ty Cobb, quietly.
Pete Rose will never get into the Hall of Fame. Gambling on the game's one thing that will keep a man out forever.
Right,
said Walter Johnson, who had not gambled or indulged in other vices and had earned himself a reputation of which a church deacon could have been proud.
That's crap,
said Ty Cobb, who had not, and who had also gambled on games and made a lot of money gambling on the stock market, too.
No, Pete Rose shouldn't be in,
Walter Johnson said.
He disgraced the game.
Ha!
Laughed Ty Cobb. He declined to explain further.
If Ty Cobb, then Shoeless Joe Jackson.
Him too. Joe Jackson ought to be in.
He took money to fix games,
said Adam.
So did a lot of guys,
said Ty Cobb.
Don't listen to that business about a lot of guys gambling,
said Walter Johnson to Adam and Robbie. Walter Johnson cared how people felt about baseball, and he'd forgotten for a moment that Adam and Robbie hadn't heard that business about a lot of guys gambling because he and Ty Cobb and Mickey Mantle were dead.
A lot of guys did a lot of bad things and got into the Hall of Fame anyway.
But let's stick with unanimously on the first ballot. Let's limit it to that.
Okay, Willie Mays.
Willie Mays again,
Ty Cobb said.
How many times do I have to listen to this?
What you have is you have time, Tyrus,
said Walter Johnson.
That's about all you've got at this point.
Ty Cobb thought about that for a minute, and he decided he wouldn't say anything more.
You want more coffee?
Sure,
Adam said. He hoped that when it came, it would be too hot to drink. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR. We have lots more coming up on Only a Game, but first I'd like to thank a Major Dome fan who left this review of our podcast. When I start to take life too seriously, especially in the arena of sports, I listen to Only a Game, whether it be a new or old podcast. Thank you for that nice review, a Major Dome fan, and I hope you're enjoying this new podcast, unless you're just now catching up on all your unplayed podcasts, and this is actually an old one. Consider a review of your own on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners to find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. I'm not sure what's happened to this frequently lighthearted segment, but this week all of our stories are about villains. Blame our guests, I guess. We're joined this time around by Will Leach from Sports on Earth via Skype and Claire McNear from The Ringer. Welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. Thank you, as always.
Will, I'm going to give you the opportunity to introduce villain number one.
I was a little worried when you played the music. I was like, wait, is the State of the Union early this year? What was... But no, apparently it's...
And we're off and running.
This week's villain is Tom Brady. I know everybody hates Tom Brady, which to me... I have to say, seems strange. I was thinking about the idea that, like, in 20 years, my children are going to ask me, wow, look at Tom Brady. Look what he did. What was it like to watch him? And I'm going to have to say, oh, well, we all responded by drawing genitalia on his face on Twitter. That's exactly what we did to respond to the greatest athlete of our time. Remember, Ted Williams was once a great villain. These great villains of their time are already now A-Rod gets his own TV show, and everybody loves Reggie Jackson now. Like, this is Tom Brady going to do something that no quarterback has ever done, win his fifth Super Bowl, playing at the age of 39, which no one has ever played at this level before, and we are all responding by extending our middle fingers when he comes on the television. This seems ultimately short-sighted.
I say this as a dedicated Barry Bonds apologist, but Brady doesn't even make a very good villain, you know? He's like Harry Potter. He doesn't really have a discernible personality apart from good at what he does.
Yeah, I feel bad about saying this, but it really does feel like mostly envy. It does feel like, oh, Mr. Perfect Guy with his perfect life and perfect everything, I hate you for all of those things.
Well, Will, there is much that is silly here, and there are a lot of people who've hated or resented Tom Brady for lots of reasons, his success, whatever, for as long as the Pats have been winning Super Bowls. Much more recently, something we should consider, when a candidate, in this case Donald Trump, before he was elected, reads a letter of support from a successful NFL coach, Bill Belichick, and refers to a successful quarterback, Tom Brady, as his pal, the coach and the athlete, whether they like it or not, whether or not the quarterback's wife likes it, which apparently she doesn't, those guys are being used. And they're going to get hated by some people, and they're going to get loved by other people who think they're doing just exactly the right thing.
To me, the most amazing thing about Belichick's letter to Trump was that, wow, Bill Belichick writes the way that Donald Trump talks. That's terrifying in like so many different sort of ways. Brady, I think, has hedged a little bit on that. And I've always felt like Belichick is the guy. Hate that guy. Like, if you want to be angry about Spygate, Deflategate has always seemed a very silly story to me, but Spygate was like, that was actually I'm trying to get the opposing team's plans and use them against them. That is empire type of stuff. Tom Brady does things on the field that we've never seen before. Bill Belichick, he does things that we unfortunately are familiar with in our daily life.
Claire, move us on to villain number two, please.
Well, so the Warriors just broke ground on their new arena in San Francisco, a ceremony that was complete with acrobats dressed as construction workers and a synchronized tractor dance. The Warriors have the best record in the NBA and were deep into the backlash against a team that just a year ago was America's sweethearts. They've tied themselves to Silicon Valley, and they've made a point of saying they're not just better than you, they're richer too, and they're glitzier and bigger and fancier. So I say welcome to the Warriors, the NBA's newest supervillains.
It's difficult to separate the players and that spectacle. The cranes were amazing, but really the dancing construction workers, like, this is actually, I think, how people in Silicon Valley think construction workers do their job, perhaps. Like, I'm not exactly sure. But for me, I try to still find joy in that team itself, to watch them. I try to hold on to that. If I start blaming the ownership of a team against the team itself, I'm not going to be able to watch sports at all.
Good point. Claire, I need a little help with this. Apart from the fact that I think dancing cranes is a really good idea, anything that diverts us from the day-to-day business of being here in the United States these days is good. But don't fans always behave this way? I mean, when they've been fans of a team that loses and loses and loses and suddenly starts winning, don't they overnight become obnoxious no matter what sport or what city we're talking about?
Absolutely. I mean, I think any superstar team, any superstar player is going to inevitably have a sort of backlash as the fans get more confident and more visible. But I think the critique with the Warriors is that there is a sense that a lot of those really loud fans are relatively new fans. And the fact that they're moving to San Francisco, I think, is particularly painful. This is a rough time to be an Oakland sports fan. The Raiders are great, but they're about to leave, possibly. The A's are perpetually terrible. And now the Warriors are moving back to San Francisco. And it's been a real bummer of a few years.
All right, I want to bring up a college basketball team. On Monday, the Duke men's basketball team lost a game at home. That brought the team's record to 15-5. Coach Mike Krzyzewski, who has been away from the bench due to back surgery, told the players they were banned from the locker room and forbidden from wearing team gear because they weren't, quote, living up to the standards of the Duke program. Coach K has a player on the squad, Grayson Allen, who intentionally tripped opponents three times. He still got to use the locker room. But losing is different. Anyway, forbidding the players from going into their locker room, I mean, why not make them sit in a chair facing the corner? It just feels to me like Coach K has made a figure of fun out of himself, and I don't think that's at all what he intended to do. What do you think, Claire?
I think that right now with Coach K out, it shows how dependent they are on him, even with a stacked roster. And he's almost 70 now. He's not going to be coaching for all that much longer, even, you know, he's coming back next month. And I wonder if some of this is his kind of frustration at that sort of dawning reality that Duke is a powerhouse with Coach K, but maybe not without him.
I would love to see Coach K try this with his Olympic team. Like, just go ahead and tell LeBron, Yeah, don't tell LeBron. Until you play better, you can't come in the locker room and see what LeBron's reaction to that is. To me, this feels like a Bob Knight, old school college basketball Hickory High move. And frankly, I feel like athletes deserve more respect than that. It's quite the thing for Coach K to say, hey, you don't deserve to wear this gear that I personally make millions and millions and millions of dollars from Nike when you wear that onto the court every day and you don't get anything for it, but you don't deserve it to wear it. It starts to feel like a little bit more than just a college basketball coach move and more worrisome type of power.
Yeah, man, beyond all that, what happens if Duke loses another game? That they make the players turn in their free Nike sneakers and walk around the campus barefoot, I guess. My guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been Will Leach of Sports on Earth and Claire McNear of The Ringer. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks so much for having me.
A pleasure as always.
When Heather Anderson was a kid, she was quiet, studious, not interested in sports. She spent most of her time indoors, reading and writing. She was perhaps the last person in the world you would expect to break a world record or three, but then she did in Seattle. Eilish O'Neill has her story.
Heather Anderson and I meet for a run around Seattle's Green Lake. She's a wiry 35-year-old who runs with an easy stride. Heather wasn't always like this. Growing up in rural Michigan, she didn't go on runs. She didn't like to exercise. She was overweight, and her classmates teased her.
They called me fat, and they called me a bookworm, and just like general like making fun and teasing.
Heather went to school with the same 40 kids from kindergarten through the end of high school. She says she started to believe what her classmates told her.
That, you know, I was unattractive and overweight and socially awkward and all these things, you know, there was something wrong with me.
Heather says she wasn't just insecure, she was extremely anxious. She was scared of the wild animals that might be in the woods behind her parents' house. She was scared to go to the bathroom alone at night.
I just remember one night just being like, this is not the way it's going to be from now on. Like, this just isn't going to happen anymore. And so then I just like started from that point onward consciously seeking out things that I was afraid of and doing them.
After her freshman year in college, that philosophy took Heather to the Grand Canyon. She was studying to become a minister, so she took a summer job cleaning hotel rooms by day and leading Wednesday night worship services. Heather had never been on a hike before, but on her first day in Arizona, she and her roommates set out down the Grand Canyon. It was 120 degrees out.
And everybody turned around but one of my roommates, and she was like a collegiate basketball player, and I was just like, I wanted to be athletic like she was, and I was like, I'm not turning around until she turns around.
Heather and her roommate hiked 4.5 miles down, and then they needed to go back up. Heather wasn't just a hiking novice. She was 70 pounds overweight. She'd spent the previous night in an airport, which is to say, she hadn't slept. There were red lines running up her legs because she had blood poisoning from stepping on a rusted fence the week before. And on top of all of that, she was suffering from slight altitude sickness.
I remember like leaning against the canyon and thinking, I'm gonna die.
But she didn't die. She made it out.
And then the next morning I woke up and I was like, that was so cool. I want to do that again.
Heather spent the summer hiking in and out of the canyon, often starting after work, hiking till 3 in the morning, and then sleeping for a few hours before going back to work. That summer changed her.
When I went there, I was planning to go into the ministry, and by the time I left, I was like, I want to be a dirtbag.
Heather set a goal for herself. She would hike the Appalachian Trail, a 2,200-mile footpath from Georgia to Maine. So, a few days after graduating from college, her two best friends dropped her off at the trailhead.
I gave them a hug, and I'm like, okay, bye, and then I like took off, and I was just excited.
Heather hiked from dawn to dusk, 20 to 30 miles a day. She gave herself a new name, Anish.
I could see that I was changing, like I was a completely different person. I was becoming someone else. And so, yeah, definitely like the act of naming myself was a reflection of that. You know, and being quiet and shy and introverted and staying indoors and reading books and all those things versus this person that now like lived in the woods and like walked all day and was like athletic, you know, for the first time in her life and wasn't scared of the dark and could sustain herself and take care of herself fully independently.
Anish finished the Appalachian Trail in 4 months, and then she went on to hike the Pacific Crest Trail and the Continental Divide Trail, which are similar footpaths on the West Coast and down the center of the country. Then she tried to settle down. She got married, and she took a job at a software company. But she had trouble adjusting to life in Bellingham, Washington.
What's wrong with me? Because all I want to do is forget the modern society, and just I want to go, like, live in the woods, and trying to, like, cope with the fact that that's not normal and, like, try to fix myself.
Anish spent 5 years trying to make it work.
And finally I was like, you know, you don't really need to fix yourself. Like, there's nothing wrong with you. Follow your dream, basically.
Anish got divorced, she quit her job, and she bought a bus ticket to Ashland in southern Oregon. From there, she started walking toward the Canada border.
I still had a lot of, like, emotional everything that I was processing, and so it was actually pretty tough, like, emotionally. And my body was not doing so well, like I had an injury from running.
But by the time she was done,
I felt more whole than I had in a long time. And I said that was where I decided to pursue the PCT, fastest known time.
That is, she wanted to break the record for the fastest hike from Mexico to Canada along the Pacific Crest Trail. There wasn't a women's record, so she set her sights on the record that did exist, which had been set by a man. 64 days. To break the record, Anish would have to hike 40 miles a day with no days off. That would mean getting up at 5 every day and hiking till 9 or 10 at night. One night, at 8 or 9 p.m., Anish arrived at a river. The bridge had been washed out, so she'd have to cross on foot. Night is the worst time to ford a glacial river. The water is at its highest and strongest.
There were these guys camped, and they were like, don't try it, it's too dangerous. And I was like, well, I have to, because I have to go, like, another 12 miles tonight. Like, I just have to.
So Anish stepped into the river.
It was, like, mid-thigh deep, but very, 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 very cold, because it's glacial water. So it was, you know, it was, like, tedious, because you had to go slowly to, like, ensure that you didn't fall down, because you had to find, you know, where to put your feet. But, like, the longer you were in the water, the more chance you were going to, like, trip and fall because you couldn't feel your, like, lower extremities. I almost got knocked off my feet. Like, I lifted my one foot to, like, put it down, and, like, it caught that leg and, like, basically spun me around, and I was facing downriver, and I was, like, that was definitely an adrenaline moment. I was scared because then you could, like, see the river that you would go down, which is, like, big boulders and rapids, and it's just, like, disappearing over, like, the edge of the earth, and I'm just like, okay, not going to mess this up. Focusing and getting foot back down and going back across river.
Anish says she felt she wasn't alone facing the river.
I had faith that, like, what I was doing was what I was supposed to be doing, like, as a calling in life, I guess. And, you know, it made it easier for me to face the things that were scary.
Anish made it across the river, and she finished her mileage that night. But then, 2,000 miles into her hike, with 650 miles to go, things started to go wrong.
Your legs just buckle and you fall down, and then you're just like, why did that happen? And you just get up and, like, keep going again.
But then it happened again.
They gave out on me, like, a couple times during, like, one day. And And then I was having the low blood sugar swings, like, where I just felt kind of woozy off and on.
Anish stopped so she could pick up food and snacks at a youth camp near Bend, Oregon.
And I was crying, and, like, I thought my hike was over. And then finally I basically just said, like, well, you're gonna hike out of here, and you're just gonna eat more protein at night. You're gonna eat dinner at night. We're just going to do it that way. You're going to eat a lot more food and see if that fixes the problem.
So Anish got up and walked out of the youth camp.
So even with, like, the 4 hours sitting there, I still did 50 miles that day. Like, I hiked till really late that night.
From then on, she made herself eat dinner every night. Tuna packets with bagels or dehydrated refried beans mixed with water.
I woke up more than once, like, with my headlamp still on and the half-eaten food next to me, because I could literally not stay awake to have dinner.
But she kept eating, and she kept walking. About 2 weeks later, she woke up just over 50 miles from the Canada border.
And I was like, da-da-da, life is great. And, you know, I ran into a lot of people that were out on the trail that, like, knew who I was, and, like, they were cheering for me. And so it, like, made me feel like a celebrity.
That was in the morning. In the afternoon, Anish didn't see anyone at all. She arrived at the border just before midnight.
I was just in the woods by myself in the dark at the end. I yelled, like, hurrah, you know, like, I'm done. And then I started crying, and then I was, like, walking into Canada, and I'm, like, sobbing. I was just so, like, overwhelmed by everything.
Anish had finished in 60 days, 4 whole days faster than the previous record. And yet, she wasn't satisfied.
There was just that little voice that kept telling me, like, you know, this was, like, accidental, basically. Like, there's no way you could to do this again. And to really, to like, shut that voice up, basically, I knew I had to go do the AT.
That is, break the record on the Appalachian Trail, too. So 2 years later, she did just that. She hiked the AT in 54 days, 4 days faster than anyone, man or woman, had ever done it before.
That was like the biggest thing that I conquered on that trail, was for once and for all, like putting those voices to bed. Sometimes there's still like that thing where it's like old patterns of like feeling bad about yourself, but it's very easy to just dismiss them now. They don't have any power. Most of my self-esteem issues were body image issues. And so I can be like, well, I don't care what you're trying to tell me about myself. Like, I'm not fat, you know, and I'm not unathletic or something. Like, I went and did, like, the Appalachian Trail in 54 days. Somebody can break that record, and that doesn't change the fact that I know that I did that thing, which is very difficult to do.
As the hiker named Anish, Heather Anderson conquered her fears and insecurities, but she's not finished yet. She broke her third world record in November, hiking the Arizona Trail faster than it's ever been hiked before. For Only a Game, I'm Alicia O'Neill in Seattle.
We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Ahead on Only a Game, Garrett McNamara falls in love with surfing and masters the world's biggest waves.
If you have the ocean and you have your board, nothing matters.
And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Coming up next week on Only a Game, it's the highly anticipated Super Bowl Haiku XXIII. That's 23.
Oh, that's fabulous.
People who aren't in Rome. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
I am so excited about Super Bowl Haiku every year.
It is exciting every year. The Super Bowl is a week away. Am I wrong, or has it dominated the news a little less than is customary when it's only a week away?
No, I mean, I think there's a lot going on in the world right now.
You're right.
That surpasses even Super Bowl
hype. It's distracted people from the Super Bowl.
It has, so far. We'll see when the race hits the far turn on Sunday whether that's the case.
Mark Gastineau racked up 74 quarterback sacks in his 10-year NFL career. He has now been diagnosed with dementia, Alzheimer's, and Parkinson's disease. He said this week in a radio interview, quote, "If the game is played the right way, it might not be so unsafe." Are we any closer to the right way than we were in 1988 when Mark Gastineau retired?
No, we're not. And, I mean, this is what everyone who loves football, plays football, watches football, bets on football, and organizes football has to come to grips with. The sport is destructive to the human body. You don't get many cases like Mark Gastineau, and I give him great credit for speaking out while, I mean, I hate to put it this way, while he still can, about what it's done to him. Because he's got the triple crown there. He is not going to come to a good end.
The Virginia House of Representatives has passed a law nicknamed the Tebow Bill, Charlie. Does that give Virginia residents the right to do really well in college but not so well as professionals?
And to drop to one knee and pray in the end zone. No, it allows homeschool students to participate in local athletics, something I am enormously opposed to. We will pay our school taxes so Johnny can play football, but he doesn't have to go to school with all those other people.
A lot of college football venues have luxury boxes, and that's fine. Only the University of Central Florida features end zone cabanas. Wouldn't watching a game from the end zone be just a little risky?
Well, not just risky, but it's a bad seat, as anyone who's ever sat in the end zone of a football stadium will tell you. Yeah, but sooner or later, you are going to get a wide receiver in the chip dip. You're paying, by the way, $22,000 a year to have wide receiver Bob come in and land on the chicken wings. I'm just telling you this. That's a lot of money.
On Thursday night, the men's basketball team at Louisiana Tech lost to Alabama Birmingham, but it could be said that the moral victory went to Louisiana Tech, I guess. What do you think?
Well, because of a bench-clearing brawl, Louisiana Tech had to play the last 6 minutes of the game with only four players, and guess what? They outscored UAB 20-16.
See, if that had happened earlier, they would have been okay.
That's right. I think they should play three players next game.
Yeah. Patrick Marleau of the San Jose Sharks did something on Monday night that only 11 other NHL players had ever done. What did he do?
He scored 4 goals on 4 shots, which is really a remarkable thing.
And all in the same period.
And what do you throw on the ice when a guy scores? After you've thrown your hat.
That's after three. They get the hats.
The fourth one, what do you do?
I don't know.
Scarves?
Your shoes?
Shoes? Your young child?
Shoes would hurt.
Your young child? I don't know. If it's in Detroit, you got to find another kind of fish.
No, it's got right. Octopus all gone. In this week's Is Nothing Sacred Anymore segment, I present to you the demise of the San Diego County Credit Union Poinsettia Bowl. It's 12 years it lasted. I thought it would go on forever, but it won't. What is San Diego going to do with all those poinsettias?
First of all, we all have, you know, special memories of the Poinsettia Bowl. Give me a week and I'll
come up with
one. Exactly. The San Diego Bowl Game Association announced that it's dropping the Poinsettia Bowl to focus on the Holiday Bowl, and it's going to start playing the Holiday Bowl downtown in the Padres Stadium, because obviously the San Diego football stadium is going to go away because San Diego doesn't have a football team anymore. But it does have a bowl game association, which will go on.
And finally, Charlie...
The greatest story we have ever done on the show, by far.
All right, here it comes. Let's give Carrie Johnson kudos for having the willpower to leave that blackjack table at a West Virginia casino last August.
Sports!
Where'd he go after he left that table?
First of all, let us set the scene, okay? He puts down the $25 chip at his seat, which is what to do to hold your place at a table. But Carrie was not going for another beer or another graze at the all-you-can-eat buffet or even to the facilities. Carrie got in his car, drove 13 miles to Charleston, robbed a bank, got back in the car with his stolen money, and kept playing.
Was the stolen money lucky?
The AP story is sadly lacking these details.
That's too bad.
But he robbed a bank, and he brought the money back, and he gambled with it.
Do you suppose it ever went through his brain, they'll never find me here in this casino?
With this stack of money that the red dye bomb
is purple
exploded.
All over my shirt.
That's right.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated. And it may be as funny as what we've just done, but I don't know.
He joins
me each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
The Super Bowl is almost here. The Falcons are ready. The Patriots are ready. The networks are ready. Roger Goodell is, well, maybe not so much. But how about you?
Please send haiku now. Super Bowl hype, very loud. We need quiet truth.
Help Only a Game celebrate Super Bowl haiku XXIII. Email your poems to us at oag@wbur.org and look for our submission page on the Only a Game website. Dharma, it's a Sanskrit word that has more than one meaning, but however it's defined, there's an implication, the idea that every person has a path he or she must follow. When you ask 49-year-old pro athlete Garrett McNamara for his definition, he struggles a little bit.
Dharma, it's just, that's a great question. Dharma is just, I don't know, that's a tough one for me right now.
But when you ask McNamara how Dharma led him to his passion and lifted him perhaps higher than any athlete in his sport, he doesn't struggle at all. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Garrett McNamara loved skateboarding with his friends in Berkeley, California. But in the late 70s, when he was just 11 years old, that all went away.
My mother married this guy, his name was Daryl, and he was moving us to Hawaii. And he was a musician. He was working with Don Ho's daughter, actually. And then he ended up meeting some girl, left my mom, and me and my mother and my brother were stuck in Wailua at Cement City, was pretty much the armpit of Oahu.
Garrett and his family went on welfare. They lived on macaroni and cheese and frosted flakes. We had nothing, he says, not even skateboards. But then the Dharma kicked in.
I don't remember where the surfboard came from. I think the garage sale, or we found it in the bushes, but we got our board and that was it. The first time I tried surfing, we went out in front of Cement City, and I just remember falling in love. It just instantly became all I wanted to do. It's just the most amazing feeling to be out there in the water, riding waves. It's like walking on the water. Nothing matters. If you have the ocean and you have your board, nothing matters.
Garrett began to master the technically challenging small waves of Oahu's North Shore. But his growing obsession presented a problem.
In Hawaii, you got two choices. You go left to the beach, the most amazing fun of your life, or go right to school. I went left a lot. When I was 17, I was getting ready to graduate from high school. I had C's, D's, and F's. And I was so afraid of the world, so afraid of what I was going to do. Am I going to have to be a waiter? Am I going to have to be a carpenter? What am I going to do when I get out of school? Man, maybe I should just try and flunk. I really contemplated this. I'll flunk and I'll stay in school another year, so I have another year to figure it out.
McNamara didn't have to figure for very long. He entered a contest in the Hawaiian Triple Crown Series, where he'd compete against the world's greatest surfers on waves larger than he was used to. He didn't win it, but he did make it to the main event and into the money.
So I gladly accepted the $250, and all of a sudden, wow, I am a pro surfer, okay. So I went to school a lot more and made sure I passed, graduated, and I've been a professional surfer ever since. Once I became pro, it was such a relief. Wow, I get to do what I love to do.
For the next few years, he competed on the pro circuit. His travels brought him to Japan, where he was a celebrity. He made good money in competitions, appeared on the covers of the big surfing magazines, and racked up endorsement deals. He was a surfing success by every measure.
I felt like I was as good or better than anybody. I thought I was invincible. I thought I could conquer any wave, ride any wave, survive anything.
It was 1989. McNamara was one of 28 surfers invited to compete in the Eddy, a big wave tournament in Oahu scheduled each year from December to February. It doesn't go on if the waves aren't at least 40 feet high. Most years, it doesn't even happen. But on January 28, 1990, Garrett and 27 other surfers got the call that the contest was on.
And the next day, the swell of this year is coming, and then the biggest set of the day comes. I take off in a perfect spot, and I stood up all confident and like, yeah, I got this. I'm conquering this wave is kind of what I'm thinking. It just flings me in the air, and I land in the flats on the bottom, and I look up, and I see the biggest barrel ever come over me. And then I land right on the tail of the surfboard, and I didn't realize it as I hit, but it kind of just like gave me a punch in the ribs. And I'm underwater getting pounded, and I'm actually really happy and having a great time, and I come up all excited and ready to go back for more. And all of a sudden I'm paddling out and I start coughing up blood, and I find out that I've broken a rib, herniated my disc. I was on the floor for 4 months, and all the sponsors that I had gained ended up dropping my salary or dropping me altogether. And so it really humbled me. I didn't see much of a career ever resurfacing.
McNamara was just 22. For the next 2 years, he lived in constant pain. But he says he's lucky. His back healed completely. In 1992, he returned to the water and focused once more on small wave tournaments. He made a respectable, if unsteady, living. He married in 1994. He and his wife, Connie, became parents the next year. Garrett opened a surf shop in Oahu to help support his family. He struggled with the idea of having one foot on his surfboard and one in the shop.
So now I was at a crossroad. I was like, why am I doing this?
Over the next 6 years, McNamara didn't surf very much. During long days indoors, he daydreamed. He'd scribble inspirational notes in his business log and gaze longingly at the ocean on his drive to work. But at the age of 35, he entered and trained for the 2002 Peahi Challenge on Maui, also known as JAWS, for its dangerous 70-foot waves.
When I jump in the water, all of a sudden, it's Dharma, the place that you feel you're supposed to be, and it's so fun and so amazing, so enjoyable. And all of a sudden, you're a little kid again, and you go, how could I ever have thought that I didn't need this?
McNamara won the contest and pocketed the $70,000 first prize. He closed the shop and focused on tow-in surfing, where jet skis pull surfers to the peaks of fast-moving big waves. He wanted his name associated with monster waves, the heaviest of the heavy. McNamara and his second wife, Nicole, were invited to the Portuguese coastal town of Nazaré, which some believe has the biggest waves in the world.
When we arrived in Nazaré, we walked up to the cliff and I saw the biggest waves I've ever seen in my life. It was like the ta-da moment. I mean, I looked and just went, oh my God.
Garrett and his wife stayed in Nazaré for months, getting to know the surf and the people. At 11 o'clock on the 11th day of the 11th month of 2011, the waves got bigger. Garrett got into the water with a team of jet skiers.
My wife, we hear her on the walkie-talkie, there's a big set coming. And I look and the whole horizon stands. And there's this monster, the massive wall. And I'm fading back and I'm looking at all the chops and I'm looking at the cliff and I'm looking down the line at towards the end of the wave. As I'm going toward the bottom, there's all these chops coming up the wave. And usually the chops at Nazaré are really violent and massive and your board hits them so hard. Usually it's like, bah, bah, bah. And this one's like, just smooth and perfect.
At the end of his ride, McNamara was buried by the wave. But he'd been buried before.
And so it wasn't like anything that I thought was out of the ordinary.
But it was.
We go to the harbor, and they come running down with the pitchers, and we look at it, and we're just like, whoa. And a panel of surfers measures the waves, and surprisingly, they measured it 78 feet and gave me the world record.
In 2013, he again caught a monster wave in Nazaré, not to break his own Guinness record, just for fun. That wave was estimated at 100 feet. There's still disagreement about its size. And another surfer may have gone even higher at Nazaré. But Garrett McNamara says that it just doesn't matter to him.
It was about going out there for the right reasons, going out there for the love of it, and just not expecting anything in return, and everything just comes together.
Dharma.
For Only a Game, I'm Gary Wallach.
Learn more about Garrett McNamara's surfing career in his book, Hound of the Sea. You can watch him ride the 100-foot wave at Nazaré on YouTube. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder, Mike Garth, Mike Moschetto, Bob Oakes, Jamie Bologna, George Hicks, and Kelvin Brooks. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Ryan Fitzgerald, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from surfer Garrett McNamara.
You know what? I'm afraid of horses. I won't jump out of planes. I don't swim with sharks. But I love big waves.
Yeah, okay, Garrett, because there's no way there's any sharks under those big waves. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.